Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today both authors of the fabulous new book published by Oxford University Press titled The Suffragist Peace: How Women Shape the Politics of War. From the title, you can already tell this is going to be a fascinating conversation with both of the authors, Dr. Robert Traeger and Dr. Jocelyn Barnhart, who in this book examine how the political influence of women once they receive the vote at the ballot box, have shaped the course of war and peace in a bunch of different times and places. So I don't want to give too much away, but Jocelyn and Robert, I'm very pleased to welcome you both to the podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for having us.
Before we dive into the very interesting findings of your book, would you mind each introducing yourselves a bit and explaining not just why you decided to write this, but also maybe why you decided to write it together? Going maybe to Jocelyn first.
Sure. So I am a professor of international relations at University of California, Santa Barbara. I'm also currently a senior research scientist at Google DeepMind in London. And the topic was very much relevant to things that I was considering at the time related to public opinion, how public opinion shapes foreign policy. It essentially bubbled up from these particular interests also in the democratic peace theory and potential explanations for why we see democracies that supposedly don't fight each other. It just kind of brought a lot of these particular issues together. I'll pass to Robert.
I'm Robert Traeger. I'm a professor of political science at UCLA and also the international governance lead at the Center for the Governance of Artificial Intelligence. Why did I decide to write this book? Well, it started by happenstance looking at data that I had collected, actually experiments, so-called survey experiments on human populations, and just noticing these huge gender differences in people's preferences over war and peace and whether they would advocate for their own country to go to war or not. And I had a bunch of data, not just from the United States, but we'd collected data also from Egypt, Israel, and Turkey at that time. And we saw the same huge differences in all these different places. And so that got us thinking. And we wondered, I think Jocelyn and I had a conversation in which we wondered if this wasn't sort of maybe the simplest possible explanation for the democratic peace, which people have said is like a law in international relations, but nobody seems to think we have a really convincing explanation of.
Always interesting to understand kind of how initial motivations come together and then result in the book that we can now, of course, read. So thank you for giving us that bit of background context. And jumping off a little bit, Robert, on what you were just saying, I was wondering if you could tell us more about sort of why we should be thinking about gender differences when we're looking into war and peace and preferences around that.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great question because, you know, the first thing that we did was we looked at differences in averages. So people who self-identified as men versus people who self-identified as women. And of course, we'd like to have more nuanced categories than that, but we didn't have them. We just had data on that. And so we looked at these averages, but I think it's fair to ask, you know, should we actually look at averages? Because, you know, not all averages, an average might be used for a political purpose. And, you know, maybe in some cases, it's the wrong sort of question to ask. So, you know, did it make sense in this case? Well, we thought that it did. We thought either from a constructed gender perspective or from a biological perspective, it was at least worth asking the question if there was a difference here. And then when we looked at data, it's like, well, there is a huge difference here. There is a huge difference, and it's not just in one place, but it's all around the world. So our view was we better figure this out.
And I'll just add there that, I mean, I think that, you know, that's a kind of a fundamental faith in that democracies are working as we think that they should, that in essence, if you have these systematically different preferences that are then integrated into an electorate, that those should in some way, you know, be have some effect on political outcomes. And I think it was also just, you know, a level of intrigue as to whether or not we could find evidence that if in fact that was the case.
I'd love to start us back in the earlier chronological part of the book, because this idea of there being such distinct preferences for war and peace based on gender is very much something I read in the book that you guys found that suffragists, people who wanted women to have the vote, very much believed in, right? That there was this idea that there would be a difference if women were to be involved in politics. Now we can then get later on into kind of whether or not that's true and how that's worked out in practice. But Jocelyn, could you maybe start us off explaining kind of what the beliefs were at the time around gender differences, what this had to do with preferences of war and peace in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century time?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this was a really fascinating to go back and look at the world from that perspective of, you know, very early and fundamental suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Carrie Chapman Catt. And, you know, they had a view that, you know, they wanted the vote, but the vote would be in service of a desire for other things, one fundamental example of which was peace. And so they really did see that there were these, you know, at the time, I think it was obviously far more common to talk about kind of essentialized views of gender. And, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, had this famous speech entitled The Destructive Male, in which she really, you know, suggests that the male element is destructive and selfish and violence loving and acquisitive and, you know, quite a negative depiction of what masculinity was at that time. And in contrast, they saw feminine honor as being much more bound to, you know, to essentially purity and chastity and you know, that the maternal role of the woman essentially placed them in a far different position. They talked both about, you know, they clearly talked about gender differences and preferences for war and peace, and they did it both from kind of an angle of socialization and an angle of innate tendencies. So that you definitely saw this notion that there was this innate desire within men for status and competition, and that women, kind of irrespective of their mental training or their socialization, tended to revolt against war. They also appreciated potential socialized elements of this, that, you know, if business and politics were really the domain of men, these were areas of competition, and that this competition, these notions were instilled into young men, and that this, you know, essentially translated into masculine notions of honor on the battlefield. Whereas, you know, women, your young women, young girls were nurtured in very different ways that, you know, they also saw as a foundation for these later differences.
And so Can you tell us a bit more about, kind of, given this difference in belief of fundamentally what one group and the other group are kind of meant to be thinking, how did women try and challenge these masculinist beliefs about war and peace? And did they get anywhere with these challenges?
Yeah, they certainly wanted to. So in the era before voting, you had these early suffragist campaigns in which one of the kind of the most fundamental things that was called for in the Seneca Falls in 1848 was, in fact, the vote, right? They called for many, many freedoms and liberties for women throughout those hearings, but really calling for the vote was the one that was, seemed to be the most gasp-inducing in a way. But at the time, obviously, it would take them many, many decades and around the world to achieve that. And in the interim, they realized that, they could resort to things like marching in the streets, as they did in 1914 with the Women's Peace Parade, as, conflict was, starting to bubble up within Europe. You would see 1,500 women in all dressed all in black marching down Fifth Avenue and essentially protesting the idea, as I think Carrie Chapman Catt said, that they were trying to they envisioned women as, in essence, humanizing governments. I like also the idea that Julia Ward Howe, in the United States, had this original conception of a Mother's Day in 1870, which was not as we conceive of it now, but that it was motivated by mothers wanting to essentially call to attention the, pain inflicted on mothers through the act of war. It was 1870. It was the time of the Franco-Prussian War. And so Mother's Day at that time was far less festive. It was much more about women giving public speeches about the horrors of war and why mothers in particular were well positioned to speak against that. So at that time, this was what they could do. They could engage in kind of traditional activist activities. Obviously, when World War I erupted, then it actually became, seen as potentially treasonous to still talk in these ways against war. And so there were these kinds of fundamental tensions between women acting for peace and acting for the vote at the beginning of World War I. They were essentially had voice, but only, in a public domain, that there was no sort of fundamental integration of those voices into the democratic process.
Of course, though, women do get the vote, thankfully, in a whole bunch of places, in fact, in most places, though at various different times and in all sorts of convoluted ways. But that allows us then to have the data, Robert, that you were talking about collecting around kind of what happens in practice, what happens when those voices are able to be expressed at the ballot box. So Robert, can you tell us a bit about that data? Are there gender differences when we actually analyze what people do in a voting booth?
Oh, yes, there are. So as I've said it, across time and place, there are these differences that we see in the data. And it's not just us who have analyzed that. A bunch of folks have gone out and looked at surveys that are done around the time of conflicts to see what the who approves of sending troops off to war, for instance, is a question that is very often asked. And even if we go back to the earliest days of polling, which is actually the Gallup organization around the time of World War II, we see exactly this same gender gap on the use of force. And what's interesting is that, to say, I suppose, the obvious, neither men nor women should be essentialized, and neither are women pacifists, nor are men warmongers. And it's interesting, though, that the same factors seem to influence both genders. That is, if women don't want to go to war by a large majority, probably a large majority of men don't want to go to war either. And when the reverse is the case, the genders also trend together. And so actually, when we look at the time series over time, we see that men and women are sort of varying together, whether they're going up or they're going down. It's usually happening together because often the same factors are affecting both men and women. But there is this gap, this difference, where on average, women are less approving than men are. So one of the things we did, since people had already collected a lot of data on polling from particular conflicts, but we wanted to drill down into what was going on. And so we actually collected all of these survey experiments that people in the international relations field had been doing. They'd done quite a few of them in sort of context. So what they're doing is they're explaining context, some context where they think that war is maybe plausible, or but not a certainty that the population would be in favor of it. And we could use that to study a little bit more about what was actually driving things. So the first thing that we did is do a sort of significance test using all the data from all these different experiments that many people had done. And that was sort of fun because every one of them had a gender gap in the use of force. And so when we pooled the data, and you can argue whether we should really be pooling data, but anyway, we pooled the data just for fun. We did a significance test. And I think there were 67 zeros before the non-zero in the significance test. So that's like, you know, way more, a much higher level of certainty, for instance, than theoretical physicists insist on when they're looking for like the Higgs boson or something like that. So we're like a really high level of significance for what it's worth. But then when we drill down into the data, we find that women were less approving of kind of maximalist shares in a conflict. So if there's going to be some negotiated solution and that solution is going to really favor their side, women were less approving of that than men were. They seemed to be more approving of a 50-50 compromise than men were on average. And one of the most interesting findings is that the women were less interested in fighting for reputation. So that was really fascinating because I think a lot of conflicts in some ways are fought over reputation, even if it's not talked about in those terms. Might be talked about in honor terms, which is of course very similar. Thomas Schelling famously said reputation was the only thing worth fighting for. But reputation is important in the process of conflict. And women on average are just less interested in doing that. So that was very interesting to us. And on the whole, yes, there do seem to be some differences.
So if that wasn't already a big enough question, the obvious follow-up is why? Why are there differences?
Well, the why is the scary question a little bit for us because it's contentious. It's contentious for good reasons, anyways. So I think there has been a very important resistance to essentializing, and so we don't want to do that. And so we wouldn't want to say, you know, that women are always a certain way, or men are always a certain way, or anything like that. And I guess over the past, you know, really past century, there's been a kind of move within anthropology and a broader cultural move to sort of define humanity as a kind of undivided thing. And what that has in part meant is assigning any differences to culture rather than anything that is innate, culture or different experiences rather than anything that's innate. And that has been very important and has allowed us to get over things like scientific racism, so-called. And certainly wouldn't want to contest that. On the other hand, I do think it's important to ask and to allow ourselves to ask questions about where biology and gender interact and at least to think about the influences of biology alongside the influences of culture and experience. And One way of doing that is to go to the animal kingdom and look there, which is really nice because it's much, much less controversial. And of course, people can do experimental studies. And the other thing about it is the biology of aggression. The biology of aggression is what the biologists call conserved, which means it goes really, really far back in evolutionary time. And so the gene sequences that control aggression, the mechanisms of aggression in mice and, let's say, humans, are extraordinarily similar. If you just put the DNA sequences up next to each other, they kind of look the same, almost exactly the same. The triggers for aggression are very different in mice and in humans, but the underlying biological mechanisms are the same. Now, that's not exactly the same as a political preference, but it's in the ballpark, let's say. These things are complicated, and you know, we really can't get perfect answers, so we have to sort of use the evidence that's available to sort of get a sense of things, admitting that we simply don't have all the answers. Anyway, when we go to the biological, to the animal kingdom, I should say, we see lots of gender differences in aggression. And indeed, there are some theories that have a good amount of support, are somewhat contested in terms of the details, but still have a good amount of support that that seem to explain these differences in aggression. A famous one is the level of parental investment, and so when men are involved more in the parenting, then they tend to be smaller in size relative to females. And I said men, but of course I mean male animals. So in those cases, when there's more male parenting investment, we see these differences. We see the effect on size. And in addition to the effect on size, we see an effect on aggression. So the male animals tend to be less aggressive in those cases when there's more parenting investment, because then the competition for procreation is of a different sort. So in the animal kingdom, we see these differences. We can explain them to some degree, but nevertheless, sort of translating that to humans is of course a significant sort of a leap. And I don't think we have all the answers there. What we can say from the animal studies is that it really looks like gene expression is playing a really big role. That is, if we look in mice, it's what genes are expressed, not fundamental differences in, let's say, brain architecture or anything else between male and female mice. So it seems to be about gene expression. That is, you know, if you express certain genes in a mouse, you can make the female mouse behave like the male mouse and vice versa, which is actually an amazing thing to see. And I recommend some of the video. Catherine Dulac is one of the extraordinary researchers in this area. She's a neuroscientist at Harvard, and she has some of her video of these things online, which are not for the faint of heart, but are extraordinary to see. But so, you know, if we're willing to make this leap from animals to humans, then it looks like it's really about gene expression. It's not about fundamental differences in brain architecture, which right away tells you that it's not really biological determinism, because the environment can also influence gene expression. But different genes are differently expressed in male and female mice, and in men and women as well. So to sort of sum things up, number one, we don't really know whether it's biology or culture. We do know that culture has a big influence, right? But we also know that in places where the women seem to be more aggressive than the women are in other places, very often the men in those places where the women are aggressive are even more aggressive than the women are. But we know that culture has a huge effect, right? But we think, based on the evidence in part from the animal kingdom, that it looks like maybe there can also be some effects of biology, not in the sense of biological determinism, but in the sense of which genes are being expressed and how that relates to gender differences. So that's sort of where we come down. We think it's possible, therefore, that small hormonal differences lead to big societal effects, including at the level of war and peace, which when you get down to it is a pretty extraordinary thing. That's the way it looks to us, but as I say, it's uncertain.
Thank you for taking us through that. It is often the scary thing is trying to figure out why. And of course, in this sort of aspect as well, when there's so many different pieces and possibilities. So thank you for weaving us through that logic, which of course is also done very deftly in the book. And talking about these societal implications, I was wondering if we could discuss maybe some of the instances, some of the examples of the way how these gender differences that we've now heard from the data are there. We have some ideas about why they are there. So how does this actually manifest in practice when we're talking about different preferences for war and peace? Jocelyn, do you want to take this one?
Sure. So in the book, we focus predominantly on voting. We focus some on activism as well. But so we focus on voting as a primary mechanism for integrating preferences. You know, I think anyone who lives in a democracy can attest to the fact that you may have many preferences that are not in fact expressed or acted upon by your elected leaders. So we do have notions that, you know, democracies, when do they manage to actually translate preferences and average preferences within a population into actual policy? And I think there's still a lot of debate there that political scientists have made some headway. But I do think that we know that, you know, the saliency of particular topics can really have an effect. And I think that war and peace tends to be one of those. It tends to be an incredibly salient topic when it is on the agenda of an election. If it's an issue, then it tends to be one that people feel quite passionately about. So our intuition initially was that, you know, when truly confronting the potential costs of war in terms of human lives, financial costs, you know, would voters actually act and vote upon their preferences for war and peace? And so that's, you know, pretty much the fundamental mechanism here is in the act of voting, but it's also, you know, in the act of politicians trying to determine how to get the vote, that they also can recognize important, you know, salient topics for the voting public, what's going to get people to the polls. And so I think we also see a history of politicians essentially adjusting their own positions in the course of campaigning to accord with what they believe are going to be potentially the preferences of women for peace, but also other times for the preferences of men for war. So I think that you see both of these things. You see politicians acting as, you know, democracy would in part suggest they should by adjusting to where they believe there are strong inclinations for votes. And you see, you know, voters in essence also potentially punishing electors, you know, elected officials who don't fulfill their particular preferences for war and peace. So I think that's, you know, one possible way that we see this happening. Maybe Robert has some other mechanisms to add here. But I think that that's a key way. And then I think that, you know, in addition to that, even within democracies, you know, it can also be that you know, again, elected officials are not behaving as, you know, some voters would prefer. And so that you still have strong components of activism amongst women on behalf of peace. And we talk about in the book, you know, that in Israel, that you had this Four Mothers protest movement about Israeli forces that were positioned within Lebanon, and that this became they became essentially did not feel like their votes were enough. They had not essentially compelled any change in Israeli foreign policy. And as mothers of soldiers who were positioned in Lebanon, they drew a lot of attention to themselves. And politicians, essentially acknowledged eventually that this mother's movement that drew attention to this occupation, as they called it, had been responsible for bringing them around and for changing the national rhetoric and understandings of what was seen to be acceptable. So I still think that even when women have the vote, obviously with all of us in democracies, we know we still have to be active and making sure that our preferences are actually represented on the ballot, and that that our elected officials are following through.
Could I maybe add sure. one thing there?
Please.
It strikes me, when we're asking this question that. Today, it's almost conventional wisdom that there is a democratic peace. And what we believe there is that these early 19th century liberals, people like Immanuel Kant and Thomas Paine and some earlier folks like Montesquieu, that they had these brilliant ideas that democracy, the institutions of democracy, we're going to harmonize the interests of rulers and ruled such that the people fighting the wars were also going to be the people ultimately making decisions, and they wouldn't want to bear the costs of war. And I think we sort of give that a pass and think that that is sort of largely correct. And on the other hand, we have these suffragists that Jocelyn was describing some of their views earlier, and of course they were fighting for these goals, right? They're fighting for the goal of peace in many cases, much more than even the goal of voting in and of itself. They were, they thought they were going to change the world with women voting. That didn't mean to them just that women were going to vote. It meant that things that women were going to vote for would be different than what men were voting for. And they thought that women would bring about peace. And I think today, nobody takes that idea very seriously, actually. And certainly for 100 years after women's suffrage, the conventional wisdom was that it had almost no effect on political outcomes. It had a big effect in the sense that women could vote, but in terms of other outcomes, it had almost no effect. That was conventional wisdom. Many of the suffragists felt like they had failed. And so, I think it turns out that actually what we're beginning to understand is that it seems to be almost just the reverse. That is, the faith of the early liberals in the institutions of democracy doesn't really seem to be borne out. Those institutions are important because they allow the voice of the people to be heard, let's say, but it really is a question of who's voting and what are their preferences more than it is just what are the institutions that are allowing or not allowing voting. So I think, that's a fascinating thing to realize. And I don't know, maybe I'll just say two other quick things. One, just to get it out there, is that the findings that we had when we were analyzing these things statistically, which we did in many different ways, was that two democracies are almost, let me put it this way, two autocracies are almost four times as likely to fight as two women's suffrage democracies. And we don't find that much evidence that democracies without women's suffrage are less likely to fight at all.
So this, in fact, I think raises a really interesting point that I'm hoping you both can expand on a bit, as it does in the book, because of course we've been, I guess, implying a little bit that the idea here is that when women get the vote, therefore there are no more wars, right? That it's kind of that direct a line. And that idea, Robert, that you just mentioned of, and suffragists thought that then they had failed when this didn't happen, kind of is a false thing, right? War and peace, it's much trickier than that, right? It's sort of what agreements are accepted to end a war. What's the bar that has to be passed in order to start a war? What sort of actions are considered okay during a war, right? There's all these other questions. And if we just think of it as, did they stop wars, yes or no, we miss out, I think, on a lot of ways in which there can still be influence of preferences kind of below or within that binary. So could you maybe tell us a bit about sort of what you found looking at these places and times to sort of understand when we see influence of women's votes, even if it's not the kind of goal that suffragists were initially hoping for of no more war ever?
Yeah, I can get us started on that one. I mean, I think that there's a few different ways to understand the win. As you say, I mean, obviously, this was not a binary. I mean, yes, the women got the vote. There was still war. The system, you know, as Robert was suggesting, you know, there are times when whole populations will support the idea of you know, engaging in conflict in order to protect their homeland. Or, you know, I think that there's a number of conditions under which, you know, people can be pushed into conflict. And it's also the case that, you know, even if you have one country that is democratic and has a preference for peace, it does not mean they may live in a neighborhood in which that is not true of their neighbors. And so they can still end up in war. And so there's a multiple reasons that even if you have kind of increasing preferences for peace in electorates throughout the world, that this does not translate to a lack of war. I will, you know, just to kind of put this all in temporal perspective or historical perspective, you know, our data on probability of war and peace, instances of war and peace or conflict more broadly goes back to roughly 1816 and continues up to the current day. So this was the time span that we assessed statistically. And of course, you know, for much of this period from 1816 up until 1893, there were very few democracies, and those that were democracies had no women voters. And so for a good chunk of that data, you know, we didn't have any variation to really draw on to make any sort of to look at any particular correlations. But so in 1893, you know, you see women starting to get the vote in New Zealand and then Australia, Iceland, not particularly in that order, but you had a cluster of countries early on. And then after roughly 1955, you have a very, very high number of democracies, and pretty much all democracies that exist have women voters. And so you have this time span between 1893 and roughly 1955, in which you actually have variation across all dimensions. You have autocracies and democracies, and you have some democracies with and without women's suffrage. And so this was the time span that we focused a lot of attention to. This also you know, helps us in other ways, because we have all of these other explanations for why we have seen fewer great power wars since 1945. And a lot of those point to the existence of nuclear weapons or the Cold War and the balancing of geopolitical rivalries, potentially economic, you know, the idea of an economic peace. And so we have all of these ideas that explain, you know, shifts in kind of patterns of war and peace after 1945. But we focused a lot of our analysis on the period prior to World War II. And in fact, this is where we generated a lot of these key differences in seeing that democracies that had no women voters did not seem to be any more or any less warlike than their autocratic counterparts. So that kind of gets at this, the kind of putting things in historical dimension, and you know, very cognizant of all of the ways that statistics can lead us astray. We tried to employ a lot of techniques that helped us get as close as we could to being, you know, or essentially increased our confidence as much as we could that these were actually, you know, strong and meaningful correlations. The book, we obviously go into numerous case studies as well in hopes of, you know, adding qualitative support to our intuitions and our statistical findings. But back to your other point about when exactly, do we see these, the influence of women's votes. And I think as Roberts, alluded or has stated earlier, right, like countries can go to war for a number of different reasons. And reputation may not be as compelling to some voters as it is to others. Conversely, some surveys have actually found that in some cases in which the cause of war is to go and prevent humanitarian suffering, in those cases, they've actually found that women voters may have a higher approval ratings for the use of force. And so, again, this is a really, rich and, essentially multidimensional space here when we're describing war and peace, obviously. And what we have generated are these what we have, the book talks about is kind of these fundamental shifts. But as you suggest, there's a lot of complexity here, and there's so much more research to be done. I think is kind of the good news for those who are looking for, if the topic is of interest, there's so many other different dimensions of pathways to go on to really figure out, what's happening here.
Always an exciting thing to learn. Robert, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think I'll add just one thing, which is, as on this question of when, what we find is an interaction between suffrage and the quality of democratic institutions. So lots of autocracies have women's suffrage, they say, but the voice of the people, be they man or woman, is not being heard in those cases. And there's just huge variation in the quality of democratic institutions. And if that quality is low, then having suffrage isn't going to help so much. And certainly one aspect of the quality of democratic institutions are the protections for women who are going to the ballot box, which you might think is something that exists everywhere in the world now, but it is not so, actually. Yes, everywhere in the world just about has formal women's suffrage, but the women who are going to the polls are not always protected. It's not always such an easy thing for them to do. So just to give you an example, in Afghanistan in 2013, there was a rule adopted requiring body searches when entering polling stations, which was, culturally offensive to women and not something that they could even if they were willing to submit to, was not something that necessarily would be accepted for them to submit to. Similarly, in 2019, there was another law adopted requiring that people going to polling stations had to be photographed. Well, in Afghanistan, it's not always acceptable to reveal your face if you're a woman. And so that was yet another deterrent to women who were going into a polling station. So the quality of democratic institutions and the protections for women who are going to vote are still things that vary greatly around the world. And I think that's, that's worth being aware of. And it's an issue for things like foreign policy of countries that are involved, let's say, in nation building, because to take the United States as an example, which has been involved in that in somewhat recent years, when the United States goes in and tries to build a democracy, there are questions and there are trade-offs that it has to weigh in how it does that. And in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, there has been a trade-off in some cases between advocating for women's rights and protections on the one hand and advocating for other institutions of democracy. And in some cases, the United States has really decided in favor of, well, we don't think we can get women's rights, so we're really going to focus on these other aspects of democracy. And I think that this work is sort of highlighting some of the drawbacks to that approach.
Thank you for adding that in. I think those are some really interesting and important points to kind of bring to this discussion. I want to, in some senses, stay in the ballot box, or at least in the ballot booth, but think about the names actually on the ballot itself, right? Because we've been talking about women as activists, women as voters, but of course we also have women as leaders, women as candidates that can be voted for. And I was really interested in the book that you examine kind of this aspect of gender preferences when it comes to war and peace. Now, we obviously haven't seen that many female leaders of democracies, but there doesn't seem to be, at least from the naked eye, a particular correlation between having a female leader and not having war. So, Robert, could you maybe take us through sort of what we need to understand when we think about, you know, to what the challenging the myth of, oh, well, if the whole world was ruled by women, then there would be no war.
Yeah, it's not that simple, it turns out. We thought maybe it would be, and we started to look at it. And some other folks, I should say, we also drew on some really excellent research by some other folks. But it's hard to figure out, right? It's hard to figure out what the effect of having a female leader or a male leader is. And all the work that we're doing on leaders and on voting publics is from observational data. So there is a sort of question mark over all of it. I think it's important to say, you know, we're doing the best that we can and we're using all sorts of techniques to get it in different ways, but it's not as good as if we could just do an experiment. But in the case of women leaders, you have this particular problem, right? Because they come to power in particular contexts. So, you know, maybe women leaders come to power when it's very peaceful, you know, otherwise maybe they wouldn't be elected, for instance. So there's, you know, all aspects of that context are going to influence the correlation between having a leader of a particular gender and whether there is conflict or not. So it makes it really hard to figure out. And the work that was the most convincing to us in trying to get at this question was work that looked at kings and queens. So not from yesterday, but had a lot of data on kings and queens. And what they do is they use something called an instrument and a statistical instrument to get at this. And the instrument in this case was the gender of a monarch's firstborn child, which is randomized, which means it has some nice properties, and then isn't a certain predictor of whether the next leader is going to be a man or a woman, but influences that, right? And since it's randomized, it shouldn't be so correlated with other things, which makes it a good instrument. And so we looked at that study, and lo and behold, in that study, it showed that the queens were more likely to go to war than the kings. And so that's very interesting. And then they look at a number of different possible explanations for this. You know, they, for instance, look at whether there's a difference between young queens and older queens, because you might think that you just might have the idea, not that it's true, that these queens were being sort of dominated by male advisors or something like that. Well, they thought, well, if that's true, then that should be more true of the younger queens than the older queens. So do we see an effect there? And the answer is no, actually, it's not true. It looks like the older queens are maybe even the ones who are very warlike. So we looked at some more recent data and took a look at correlations there. And we looked at men and women in the US Congress. And we did a variety of analyses. And basically, it at the very least, there's no evidence that the women are more likely to advocate peace, the female leaders. And if anything, consistent with the study of kings and queens, it looks like the opposite. So that's the finding. And then the question is, why is that? And I think there are sort of two obvious explanations. One is that there's something about the process of leader selection that means that women leaders are just very different from the population of women as a whole. And possibly the male leaders are very different from the population of men. And the other explanation, which I think we sort of tend to a little bit, although I think it's not possible to really separate these effectively. The other explanation is that women leaders are so-called hiding type in some way, that in effect, they are participating in a culture, which is a certain way. There are certain expectations of them. And for instance, if they're expected to be more pacific because of their gender, that can be dangerous for them. And as a result, they have to really prove that they can do it just like the men can. And that may be forcing them in some sense to be a little bit more aggressive than they otherwise would be, which is not to say that women leaders on average would be more pacific if it weren't for this. But I think we need to hold out that possibility. And I'll just say one last thing, which is that if we want to really see the potential of women leaders, I think we maybe have to think about the cultures of what it means to be a leader that women inhabit when they are leaders. Maybe we need to understand that a little bit differently. So maybe we need broader cultural change before we can really see a change at the level of leaders, because more than we, I think, often realize, the leaders are really responding to the populations and what the expectations are in the populations than we often appreciate.
Thank you for explaining both the kind of what's happening and also why and what we might look to in the future, given what could be changing. And sort of on that idea, we've been talking through this fascinating kind of the statistics, the studies, pulling it all together, how this has happened in different places and different times. And there's some really kind of, I think, obvious implications of what we've discussed so far of kind of what we might see at the moment, how these things might be currently playing out around us. But I'd love to surface some of those, make some of those a little bit more explicit. So how might we see, or how do you think we might find gender differences, different gender preferences for war and peace shaping current politics? Don't know if Robert, you want to start with this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's shaping politics all around us. And maybe the most interocular case is the case of Japan, because actually of all the countries we looked at, that was the place that had the largest gap in preference, political preferences over war and peace between the genders. It's really a huge gap there in all the surveys that we looked at. And it's a place where a few years ago, the Abe government wanted to change the constitution. They wanted to change it so that Japan could actually use its army abroad. And the reason why they wanted to do that was basically because they wanted a closer alliance, an even closer alliance with the United States. They wanted to be able to participate when the U.S. military was doing things around the world. And the Abe government lobbied the people to try to get that done. But in order to do this, it needed to convince a sizable fraction of the people in order to change the Constitution. And it tried very hard to do it. And it was able to convince at one point, not for that long, but at one point, it was able to convince more than half the men in Japan. And so it really looks like if it weren't for women voting, probably the Constitution would have changed in Japan. But as hard as it tried, the government could not convince more than a third of women to support the policy, which meant that by a large margin, it was going to fail. And so we did not get a change in the Japanese constitution. And it, you know, then you think about the follow-on effects of that, right? Because if the constitution is changing in Japan and Japan is perceived as a more militaristic state, what happens to the whole security architecture in Asia? How do all the other countries respond? How does the world become potentially more militarized when these changes occur? So I think that's, you know, that's to me one of the fascinating contemporary cases, but there are sort of lots of these cases and lots of ways that I think when a group has the vote, they have a political power, there's a meaning behind social movements with which they're associated, that though that similar movements, when they don't have the vote, just don't have. So we see similar social movements, you know, we see women's movements for peace, not that it's only women who are advocating for peace, obviously men are involved also, but in some cases we do see specifically women's movements, and we see them before and after suffrage, but we can really feel the palpable difference when they have the vote and the leaders of the day know that they have to pay attention.
Yeah, so I'll jump in here if I may. I mean, I think it is. It's such a fascinating thing to figure out. You know, how is this thing? So we went and we found this mechanism. We were convinced by evidence from surveys and statistics and all of these historical case studies. And then you kind of look around you, and I think that there's this kind of notion of, but the world doesn't seem that peaceful. And so, how is what you're telling me? You know, how do we make sense of that? And if it is exactly, how do we know where it is? And I think that, you know, this is just kind of it's a really tricky and kind of puzzling thing, right? As Robert mentioned earlier, for a long time, there was the assumption that in kind of one of the biggest political transformations that's ever occurred in world history, which was bringing in half of the world's population into the electorate. For a long time, it was assumed that this had very little substantive effect on our world. And yet we've seen, you know, with statistics, with work done across a number of different fields, that in fact, substantial things did happen. The size of government increased and infant mortality went down and healthcare spending went up. And there are another, range of other implications that we now associate with giving women the vote, but that they were just really hard to detect at the time, because they didn't seem revolutionary. They didn't seem transformational in the way that we would expect them to. And so I guess that's, you know, the takeaway is really, it can be affecting the world as, you know, everywhere, but the counterfactual is just very, very difficult to identify. So I think that, you know, the case of Japan is a really interesting one, in which, you know, Article 9 stands today. It may not forever, right? It could be that, you know, if it was essentially Japanese women start to feel genuinely threatened by external powers, that they too may come to support conflict and the, you know, creation of self-defense forces in Japan again. But, you know, I think that it can be very hard to identify in other cases. Another case we talk about in the book is the case of Liberia. And again, that is another case where it's a pretty interocular case, in which you actually had women who were fighting against protesting the, you know, prolonged and horrible blood, civil war there, and that they essentially positioned themselves, you know, outside of the negotiations, the political negotiations, and essentially threatened to strip naked if the men came out and witnessed this, that this was going to be seen as like the most distinct form of shame. And so you saw these just true acts of sacrifice on the behalf of Liberian women who would later go on to kind of implement democracy with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and it's just you sometimes have these cases in which the effects are really clear, but you know, in others it can be very difficult to determine.
Thank you for taking us through those cases and giving us kind of a sense of what to look for, and that it is a bit about peering around and thinking it through, which of course makes it very fascinating to look at. And obviously the book goes into loads of detail. We've just sort of done a highlights tour, so anyone intrigued should definitely pick it up. And that leads me only to my final question, which is kind of, now that we know where we are at now and what we might look for in the future when we look at elections and policies around the world, is there anything either of you are working on now or next, now that this book is done, that you'd like our audience to be aware of, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic?
Yeah, I'll just jump in briefly. So what I'm working on now is seemingly quite distinct. I've transitioned to thinking about the implications of artificial intelligence on international relations and related topics. But in kind of bringing in this point on gender, it's something that I've thought a lot about in terms of risk-taking when we think about technological innovation. And are there potentially gender differences, and how likely you are to take particular risks and innovate in ways that could create societal harms, and what that might mean for how we should distribute power and decision-making authority within, tech companies and those who regulate them. So that's something related to the work I'm doing today.
I just want to say one quick thing about voting, and then I'll say what I'm working on. I just want to say that I think voting, it's fascinating because it's so much taken for granted in the world today, particularly surveys show by young people. They don't think it's a much smaller percentage say that it's essential to live in a democracy than did even a decade or two ago. And I find this frustrating, and I always want to ask my students, or sometimes I do ask my students, which of their rights they'd like to give up. They look at me like I'm just silly and not understanding things. But the thing about voting that I think this work also brings out is this privacy aspect of it and how amazing that actually is. You know, it's like if you contrast the effects of gendered leaders versus the effects of gendered voters, I think that's just fascinating, right? Leaders are out there, they are in the public. What they do has to be conforming to societal standards and a result of the image that they project in the world. But people in the privacy of a voting booth can do whatever they want. It doesn't require the social sanction of anybody else, be they of your gender or of another gender. And so I think that is, to me, an extraordinary privilege and one of the most extraordinary aspects of the modern world, in some sense, that power derives from that sort of private individual moment. And so anyway, I hope you don't give it up. But I'll actually answer your question now, which was what am I working on? And somewhat similar to Jocelyn, I'm also thinking about how we design international institutions to govern artificial intelligence, the emerging technologies of the day, and in particular artificial intelligence, are the things that have, I would say, worried me the most recently in terms of what they mean for the world and what's likely to happen if we don't get governance of these technologies right. And I think some people hold out hope for sort of technical solutions to technical problems. But I think if we look historically, what we see is that very often there actually isn't a technical solution to a technical problem. We actually need a social solution. And so that's what I'm working on now.
Well, you both clearly like tackling big questions. So thank you for sharing that with us, and best of luck with all of those projects. Listeners who have been intrigued by our discussion can pick up the book we've been talking about, titled The Suffragist Peace: How Women Shape the Politics of War, published by Oxford University Press. Jocelyn and Robert, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.